Welcome back to episode 141 of Chess Journeys, Tales of Adult Improvement. Here on Chess Journeys, we love to explore the glory of rating gain, but we also dive into the plateaus and perhaps below that, the pits of despair. If you want to support the show, you go to Patreon Chess Journeys. I want to thank our queen level supporters, Blundergoat, Tim Everett, Scott, D4B6, Joe, Matt Bush, Jay Garrison, Don Rich Burgess, Brandon Hallside, Jeff Peterson, Tobias Rex, Bob Berger, Nicholas Harrigan, Rich, Bradley Fenner, Fletcher Ray, Nathan Peterson, Christian Glaw, and King level supporter, Ian Samples. If you want to appear on the show, you can fill out the Google form and the show notes. We all want to hear your story. You can also DM me on Twitter. That works quite well. Now, I've got a couple opportunities for you if you're interested in chess improvement, which I think you are. First of all, Noel Studer has two programs you can join. He's got his one for beginners. He's got his program for more advanced players. And there's a code in the show notes below. I've also been using the Chess Gym quite a bit for their calculation puzzles. They've got a lot more than just that. That's just what I've been using. And there's a link in the show notes to support the show and to join that program if you want. But today, we bring on our guest, Benji. He's an adult improver. He's a data scientist. He's a mental chess coach, even worked with the English chess team at the last Olympiad. Benji, welcome to the show, and have you had a chance to play any chess yet today?
Thank you so much, Kevin. And yes, indeed, I am a little bit addicted to Blitz. So sure. Often get at least a couple of games per day.
Okay, and what's a Blitz game for you?
Maybe 3+2. Yeah, that's my time control.
3+2 is your time control. And do you do anything with them, or are they just kind of like a fun thing you do to relax or whatever it is, whatever role they play in your day?
Yeah, it's not so much with an improvement lens. It's just for mindless fun.
Yeah. I saw the other day on Twitter, the debate started raging again, right? Of like, is Blitz just mindless fun, or can you use Blitz to improve your chess? I don't know. I've still been convinced myself that if you analyze the games afterwards, that's the key. You do get a big volume of games and it can be helpful. I'm not saying it's the best, but I feel like it's a supplement to improvement. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I think clearly for amateurs, they're useful if you make something out of them. Like, let's say you use it to plug your opening repertoire. I think that's really good for opening work because you get exposure to a lot of variations and structures. And if you review tactics that happen into it, that can be very valuable. This whole debate of such and such player got strong because they grew up on Blitz. I'm quite skeptical about this. It's kind of like, I'd like to really see the data or understand the data because, some of these strong players of the so-called Blitz generation, they also do all the super hard work and the endgame studies and hours of analyzing their own games. And so it's kind of like, well, is it like because is it just that they did all the hard work and also they happen to play some Blitz? But we don't really have the data. So it's kind of like, a fun little Twitter micro drama again.
Yeah. Spoken like a true data scientist. I like it. We don't have the data. I think that's where my intuition is as well, that it's like the kids that sort of grew up with Blitz. If you're already doing all the hard work and then you layer on top of it endless games that help you cement the work you did, I can see that being very productive. What I see less productive would be like, I've never studied. All I do is play chess. And then miraculously, I became amazing. That feels less likely to me.
Yeah, because say, I don't want to put words in Ikaru's mouth, but his father-in-law is a highly respected coach. Yeah. And so, maybe he didn't study, books and classics, but he got all this education, through this type of study. But I have to say, you know, I do love books, whether they're chess or any type of books. I love the objects. I just love books. So, you know, the fact that Magnus at the end of the day is like, yeah, I've read like any chess book under the sun, and I've always loved reading chess books. I'm like, yes, team books.
Yeah, I hear. I'm on team book as well. Yeah, it feels like team book is getting smaller by the moment, but we'll see. It can be very interesting if in 20 years from now, chess players like books. I just watched Gotham videos, and you're like, oh, the book days are over. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, these digital tools, they allow you to, you know, for sure progress at a faster pace than books. But, you know, unless you're really, you know, in the 0.1% of trying to, you know, shoot for the moons, like, you know, books,
yeah.
Books are great. And there's been also recently even more discussion about like the tactics trainer versus the books. And yeah, I think it's quite interesting because tactic trainers, yeah, there's this tendency that you can make the first move and then see where it goes if the first move is obvious. Whereas in a book, you really train your visualization from that position. And I think that's the big, that's a big advantage of books. And I'm not sure it's so much in the, I mean, sure, the puzzle selection also plays a role, but I think if people really focus only on the puzzle selection, I think it's the fact that you see, you basically have a harder visualization workout from the book that is very important.
Yeah, I think my big takeaway from that discussion is that like the books make you do it the right way, whereas online gives you the option to do it how you want. And it's so tempting to do it the wrong way, right? Like even me who knows I want to do it the right way, every now and then I feel myself being like, that move looks fine. And then moving and being like, what are you even doing? Now you're not doing a puzzle anymore. You're just like using intuition to make moves on a screen just to get rating points. And what is the point of that even? So yeah, I hear you. For myself, I find that books allow me to go deeper somehow. Like the material I learn in books stays with me much longer because I have to be more interactive with it. I'm like talking it through myself as I'm reading the book. Whereas for whatever reason online, maybe it's because they're so good already at communicating it, it more washes over me and I'm like, okay, cool. And then I've forgotten it all very soon after. So I don't know. That might just be my own, you know, age showing there where I'm not as good at digesting digital media. I don't know. Well, Benji, let me ask you a question here.
Go ahead.
So, when did you get started in chess? How old were you? Did you learn as a little kid? What's your chess backstory like?
Yeah, I think I did learn other pieces moved as a child, but never really, you know, played any serious games. And in my mid-20s, I got into board gaming, you know, modern German board games, and really into it. And we were going to a board game convention.
Ooh,
and
Essen?
No, it was a small one actually in Manchester. Okay. I've been to Essen many times, but to a smaller convention. And somehow the chess club had a room there. And, you know, they were like, oh, come over. And like, and then I started to move the pieces and, you know how chess has a way to like warm itself into your brain. So, I didn't quite stop, playing, you know, modern, strategy games, but you know, definitely I got hooked on chess after this.
Nice. It's so fun to talk to a board game because most people who are like, I play serious board games. I'm like, oh, cool. What do you play? And they're like, I play Settlers of Catan. And I'm like, okay, come on now. That's fine. That's a good game, but it's not like, we're not talking about like serious Euro board games here. So give us like a top three favorite board games.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's what's fascinating is how little overlap there is between the chess community and the board games community. And I think you know, there'd be really, I'm sure a lot of chess punks would love some of the modern board games. One of my top three, I have to say, is Terra Mystica.
Okay.
So, you know, as just an absolutely, you know, modern classic. I'd have to bring a game by a designer that I love, Reiner Knizia. Tigris and Euphrates would be in my top three. And I guess another modern classic, I'm going to say Terraforming Mars.
Okay, so you're picking some big ones. Yeah.
Yeah, I like, but I also love, you know, for a very long time, abstract games were not in fashion whatsoever. You know, you had to have like a theme. And I think in the 90s, a Belgian designer called Chris Boehm started this series called GIPF. And he started to crank out a set of, you know, really punchy, fun, abstract games. And that kind of sparked a mini, you know, all of a sudden it's like, okay, well, these games can be cool and you don't need a theme and it can be, you know, chess-like in terms of like all the information's in front of you. And and now you regularly have like really new, fun little designs coming out.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating that you said there's not much overlap, because it feels like there's so much overlap between chess and board games, where it's like the deep strategy, you know, thinking turns ahead, trying to figure out what your opponents are going to do. At least the ones you described are quite lengthy and, you know, they take a long time to really go over. And then you get to add a fun social dimension where you're playing with your friends and talking the whole time. I don't know, it just seems like chess players, or at least many chess players, would really like board games. So I guess for sure. This is now a board game podcast for chess players.
It is. It is.
All right. Well, excellent. All right. So you said you picked up chess then in your 20s at this board game convention. Was it like full throttle right away? Or are you kind of like, oh, it's one of the board games I play now?
Yeah, I was probably like early 30s when I started to play chess. And yeah, I kind of joined a club and then went, you know, a slow, really motivated to improve and play rated games and things like that. So in England, where I'm based, there's quite there's a very vibrant you know, club scene. So I joined my local club, Metropolitan, and started to play in the London League. And it's really a case that these clubs, there's like maybe I can't quite remember, but at least five or six divisions in the London League. So, you know, dozens and dozens of teams, and every club's gonna have like, you know, four or five teams. So even if you're a brand new beginner, you can play team chess and be part of a eight board team and play during the week, and that's great. I mean, you know, just getting started and all straight away you're part of a team and you can play these rated games. That's really cool. So I was with Metropolitan for a few years, and then I joined the Hammersmith Chess Club. Shout out to Hammersmith. They were very very at the forefront of doing events and being very open and also focused on inclusivity and all of these aspects made like, wow, that's great, that's something, you know, I want to be part of and help out. So I've been a member of Hammersmith for the past 4 years. And we're doing cool stuff. So, for example, we are going to Paris in June to play, you know, a friendly match against Paris a club in Paris. So, you know, I'm helping out to organize this. So, chess in London's a fantastic place to play chess.
Yeah, I'm really jealous. That sounds amazing. All right, couple of questions. First question: what was your first rating when you started? Were you like 100? Were you like 800? What are we looking at?
Ooh, good question. The thing is, I can actually, I should be able to go back because I, when I started out, maybe that was 2012, I started to play on chess.com, which was one of the first, you know, it was not very old. So I could go back to my, you know, rating history. I know that I do in puzzles and, because I went from 700 to 2700 puzzles in 10 years. Yeah, it's fun to have like, you know, a long history. I think my first rating was about 100 ECF or below that, which I'm not quite sure because so before in England, they had their own rating system. You know, so not all games are FIDE rated. And it was a three-digit grade, which, you know, of course creates like lots of headaches because you need to compare and so on. And now they've moved to four-digit grades. So I'd have to go back at my rating history, but probably something around 1200 or something like this.
Okay, well, that sounds fun. When you switched clubs, because the club scene is so like, serious and vibrant, were they like, what, you can't leave, or was it, is it easy to still like switch clubs if you want to, like how does that work?
No, I mean, it was really like, you know, no hard feelings. There wasn't a big dramatic moment. It's like, you know, they were like, you know, you're always welcome back. And actually, I do enjoy coming back to the club to you know, to play as an away player. I think it's there's we have like this friendly rivalry with between Hammersmith and Battersea, so you know we try to, you know, meme on Twitter and stuff like that, but it's friendly banter because we love to have, you know, a beer with each other, but it's also nice to, you know, we're trying to create a rivalry to just, you know, just make things interesting.
Okay, so what it sounds like what you're saying is I should just move to London. That's what I'm hearing from this whole conversation, because it's just for the chess scene.
You've got lots of weekend tournaments. So I've played, you know, quite a lot of these where you play one game on Friday night, and then on Saturday you've got two games, and then two games on Sunday. So it's like five games over the weekend. And that's like, you know, I think the basic template for what we call congresses in England, and these are very popular and fun to play in.
Nice. And so you said you guys are setting up a match with in Paris. Would you be interested in setting up a match with our local team by my house? If you can sponsor us, we'll all fly out to London to play you guys.
Yeah, we'd have to find a sponsor so that we can do, you know, the move back and forth. We're trying to find you know, places which are easy to have matches against. In the past we've been to Ostend, we've been in Poland as well. So, you know, because from London, really, you can fly, you know, within 2 hours, you can fly to so many parts of Europe. But, you know, we'd love to one day, maybe going to the US.
All right. We'll keep that in mind. All right. Let's talk about your improvement journey. How serious were you at the beginning? So you joined this club. It sounds like you probably want to get good as fast as you can because you're like competing with your club. You probably want to represent your club well. So what did that look like for you? Like, what did you start doing to try to get good?
Yeah, great question. I mean, there were not as many... I mean, even though we're only talking 10 years ago, there were a lot less, you know, YouTube resources or even the quality of books that have gone, that have been published, you know, even just in the past 5 years is massive. Eventually I stumbled upon, like, you know, you need to do tactics to, you know, get your skills up, because going through knowledge only is very difficult. So I think my first tactics book was Susan Polgar's what is it, Chess Tactics for Champions? I think that's how it's called. And it's one of these books that's organized by theme, and then you know you learn the pin, the double attack, the fork, and so on, intermediate moves and stalemates. And and I went through this, and like you know that was my first big big jump in strengths.
Okay, so you felt your rating jump up just from like spending time with a tactics book, learning all the themes for real, and actually being able to know them and process them.
Yeah, that probably brought me to like, I don't know, something like 1400.
Oh, okay, nice. And how much time were you putting in with that?
Ah, great question. I don't know how much. I was probably
Yeah.
spending like a little bit of time every day.
Okay.
So you know, obviously, you know, busy with kids and with work, but you know, when you're like on this like chess quest, you're like, okay, I'm gonna, you know, do these tactics and stuff. So I haven't tracked this. Would be fun to look at the data.
You said you
But
did track
yeah,
it or you did not track it?
I did not track
You
it,
did
you
not
know.
track it. Okay. Okay. What else did you do other than tactics?
Yeah, at some point I got a set of books by this French author. This is where is Vincent Moret, and he's got two books called My First Chess Opening Repertoire. And I was like, well, you know what? A whole repertoire in a book sounds like great.
Yeah.
So I got the book and I learned the I basically read the books from cover to cover.
Okay.
And the repertoire from was like E4 and playing the Greco Gambit as white.
Wait, what is the
Against
Greco
E5.
game? I don't know that one.
Can we do chess moves?
Sure, a
Yeah,
couple.
so
Yeah.
E4, E5, knight F3, knight C6, bishop C4, bishop C5, and then C3. And after knight F6, you go D5, and then it's like takes, and basically you end up sacrificing the E4 pawn in a lot of lines for
Okay.
a lot of initiative.
All right.
So, you know, that's like, I mean, I don't think it's like a great gambit, but it gives like, you know, a lot of practical chances and teaches you to like, you know, play. It's great to pick up as a beginner because you learn to play with some initiative.
Yeah, you learn how to
And
fight.
yeah, no, like a lot of fun line. The Grand Prix was in the book as against the Sicilian. And a year later, he published the book for the Black Repertoire, and I was like,
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
that's it. And here
He's
it's
Indian.
the it was the Portuguese Scandinavian against E4.
Oh,
So where you don't take back with the queen, but you play knight F6, and a quick bishop G5. So it's like it. Most of the time, white cannot hang on to the pawn, right? But they shouldn't. But you temporarily sacrifice a pawn for development, right? And
gotcha.
again, it's like the theme of like getting
Yeah.
and it's such a fun opening. I mean, I don't think I'd play it again against a prepped opponent over the board, because this is kind of the opening where if a strong opponent prepares against you, you're in for like
Yeah.
a world of pain, so to speak. But you know, online or you know, even when you get started, that's great. And so that was like, you know, the key. And I've always loved to learn new openings, because to me, learning openings is learning middle game structures. You know, I'm gonna play such pawn break, I'm gonna play this pawn break. I think, you know, I'm a big fan of knowing this reference game. So, for example, in the King's Indian, you've got Piquet versus Kasparov. And that's like, you know, if you want, if you actually know that game and you've gone through all the small tactical themes in that game, like that's huge. That's huge. And as a beginner, you know, your repertoire has to be wide and not too narrow. But it's a combination of like, yeah, knowing the key plans. So for this, like a reference game is going to be great. Mm-hmm. And having this like, you know, broad base of like, you know, key ideas, I think.
When you say broad, do you mean someone should know a whole bunch of openings, or you just mean not memorizing a whole bunch of lines super deep, but really just have a broad understanding of the opening you're playing?
Yeah, the latter.
Okay, gotcha.
You know, you have to have an idea. You know, even if it's just three moves against like, you know, most tries is more valuable, I think.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's such a good piece of advice. When you mentioned that sample game, is that a game you have memorized, or you've just gone through it and so then you understand sort of a lot of the themes and ideas from going through that once or twice?
Yeah, I don't have it fresh in memory right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's I think you have to know it pretty well.
Okay.
So I think it's again one resource I really love in the King's Indian is, for example, Andras Stott's YouTube videos. They're really fantastic. And it's not like, you know, a repertoire or a book, or, you know, it's not checked, but it's like, these are the ideas. This is the idea in this structure. This is the idea in this structure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to be honest, at the amateur level, I'm not sure you really need like the so-called theory.
Yeah, it's tough, because even if you know the theory, like, does your opponent know the theory, or does your opponent not want to play theory because they don't want to get caught? So it's like, you don't get a lot of just straight up theory games, right? So yeah, I hear what you're saying. Well, that's really interesting. And it takes me back to, like, you know, 10, 12 years ago when you learned an opening, you bought a book, and then those were the lines you played. And it was like, okay. It's just such a foreign concept to me now, where when I try to learn an opening, I get like seven short and sweets on Chessable, and I look up a few videos and I start sort of cobbling together what is it that I want to play, and then someone else can watch the same video where the person talks about how to beat that thing, and you're like, okay. So it's a very different time. It's a very different time. Okay, so you spent some time with openings. Did you read any strategy books? I feel like in your period, it's a Silman time, so it's like reassess your chess must have been calling out to you. Did you interact with anything like that?
Yeah, I actually did buy the Silman book, but you know what? They never really spoke to me. I don't know, because maybe there's other people like me and we just never dare speak up, but somehow his way of speaking about the game or looking at the game just doesn't never resonated so much with me. I mean, it's probably a me problem, to be honest, more than a Jeremy problem. No, it's more through like these analysis of understanding the positional concepts in, like, you know, a given position. And this is where, you know, learning new openings help. So for example, when I learned the Grand Prix, so Vincent said, like, okay, if Black plays d6, then the bishop goes well on c4, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it aims straight at f7. But if Black delays moving the d pawn to be playing, like, you know, d5 in one move, then the bishop goes to b5, and we switch gear, and then we double Black's pawn, and we play you know, a positional game against this, right? Against these double pawns. And so just from you know, this study of openings, I got these, you know, key little strategy tidbits. So I think that's how I learned strategy, to be honest.
I think that's really interesting. I think that's getting into the whole like knowledge versus skill gap, right? Of like, if you read a book like Silliman's Reassess Your Chess, you're going to get a lot of knowledge, right? But then it's like, how do I use this knowledge in a game? Whereas you are gaining your knowledge from the skill of playing a game and looking at a specific, you know, structure and the opening you play, to where the knowledge you are learning is directly applicable to the games you're playing, which I think is very interesting and sounds like a really good way to learn strategy. It almost feels like we should have a series of strategy books that are called, like, you know, learning strategies for the Sicilian player, right? And it's like, that's how you learn strategies, by reading that book. I don't know, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, but then again, you know, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Playing trumps everything, because if you play a rated tournament in a line, then the amount of, you know, understanding and details you look at in that particular position is just 10x what you would retain from being in a book. So, you know, as much as I love, you know, the books and the study and everything, I know that, you know, it's just playing is just going to give you so much, and it's going to stick so much that, you know, it's hard to understate how important playing is.
When you say playing, do you mean playing blitz games, or do you mean playing like long tournament games?
Long tournament games, yeah.
Yeah. And what is it, do you think, about playing long tournament games that helps information stick so well?
I don't know. I play... I think I play with quite a lot of... I try to bring as much intensity in my focus, in my concentration. And, you know, I really try to... It's about really trying to play the best moves. And because you spend so much time, you know, even in the, you know, early middle game, often you're gonna like be calculating and looking at things that you might not have, you know, previously looked at before. So I think it's the sheer A, amount of time, and B, the stakes of the game that makes it, you know, probably stick more.
Gotcha. So it sounds like we're spending more time during those, and we're going deeper with our thoughts because we're more invested in what's happening. Yeah. I think for me, there's also almost the emotional piece of like, because you have to sit there, especially when things go badly, and stew about it so much. You're like, I'll never do that again. I will never make that mistake again. And then when you go to make the mistake again, you remember, the emotions pour over you of the last time you did it. You're like, whoa, I'm remembering now. I had to sit there for 2 hours losing when I did that last time. I'm not doing that again. Yeah. Any thoughts on that? Do you feel like there's some emotion?
Yeah, 100%. Oh. I'm sure the neuroscientist will have, you know, something to say about the emotion allowing you to form like better memories. But 100%, yeah, the emotional connection to this is super important.
Okay. What does your study look like today? Are you still trying to get as good as you can to be the best representative of your club, or have you kind of shifted how you're doing chess away from improvement at all costs to other aspects?
I think nowadays I've completely shifted. I do enjoy, you know, playing for my club, although I don't play a lot of games. It's definitely, I will spend time trying to be a better coach in terms of mental coaching. So this is, you know, the material I'm going to be consuming and the books I'm going to read. So pure chess improvement is not on the menu anymore. But I still do want to keep playing tournaments from time to time, because, you know, I think somehow you need to eat your own cooking a little bit. I need to stay in touch with what it feels like, you know, to be tired during a game, to have these back-to-back games, this long, tiring tournament, and the ups and downs emotionally. Like, you know, if you advise people on how to deal with the ups and downs, but then you never do it yourself, it can somehow feel a little bit abstract. So I still want to keep in touch with doing these. So last year, for example, I played the Cambridge Open, and that was a lot of fun. And that was like so, it was 2 games a day for 5 days almost. Oh. And that was like, yeah, a real test of mental strength.
Did you take any buys in there, or did you play all 10 games?
I did take a bye. It was 9 rounds. The first day was a single round, but then 2 rounds a day on the Saturday, I just took a bye. So yeah, it was a little bit, it was a lot. It was a lot of chess, a lot of chess in 1 week, but yeah. So I improvement is not my, my priority anymore.
Okay. So what got you into the sort of mental side of chess? Did it start with trying to help yourself be able to endure these tournaments better? Were you just interested in the material? How'd you get into that?
I've always, you know, being a scientist and a data scientist, always focused on data and on, you know, loving to do endurance sports and health and wellness. And one day I heard an interview of a player is going to stay nameless, but about how his sleep was completely messed up. And I was like, how can this be the top of the sport? This just makes no sense. Like these people should, you know, need some help. And, you know, I could teach like a few things I know about health and wellness. That was my original angle. And I was like, I kind of like, you know, got a little bit in touch with people, but I was like, you know, to have some legitimacy as a coach, I should do like a degree, you know, to learn some basics, because you know, it's A, I want to learn, and B, I need some legitimacy. So I enrolled into a part-time coaching degree at the University of Paris, and that was during the pandemic year, and at the same time I was cold emailing some top players, and eventually one top GM was like, oh Benji, that sounds interesting. I'm not quite sure what we're gonna do together, but like I'm interested to know more. So you know, I started to work with him, and it was basically a very long transformative journey, because I really started with a wellness and data focused approach. And the more I learned about the mental side and the mental coaching, the more I was like, this is the thing that really A is the most interesting to me, and B is like so important as well. So I also got at the same time into meditation and Buddhism. So there was like this combination of these two ways in terms of like the traditional sports psychology and, you know, my own personal development journey. And I've been like, you know, mixing these with, I'm going to say great success in a way, in terms of having my own voice, and helping out people with mental things that are related to chess.
Gotcha. Did you start by doing this yourself for like when you were at tournaments, or how did you sort of like start doing this with chess players? Did you just reach out to people? Who was your first test subject? Was it you or was it someone else?
I think somehow you always, you know, start with yourself, because you know, you get interested in things because it somehow there's like an element of struggle, and then you overcome that struggle and you're like, well, this piece of knowledge that I just learned is super interesting. I think if everything's very natural to you, it's a little more difficult. I just learned this quote a couple of days ago about someone saying, like, I want to learn bench press from someone with long arms, because it's a lot harder to bench press if your physiology is not good for it, right?
Interesting.
I know there's always this debate of like, do you need to have done the thing yourself to a good coach? And that's a very complex thing. In the words of Jose Mourinho, to be a jockey, you don't have to be a horse beforehand.
Well, it's a good thing.
I think it's important that, you know, I think at my level, which is 1700, I understand enough of the struggle at the board to be able to, you know, help out players at a much higher level.
For sure. Whole thing I'm taking away from this podcast, by the way, is the reason I've never been able to bench press much is because I have really long arms. So there you go. You just made me feel better about myself, Benji. I appreciate it. All right. What is it about the mindfulness approach that you think helps a chess player? Like, what is the goal from that? What are we able to get out of it that helps us with our journey?
I think we're getting a lot from this, because it's the little bit of space between responding and reacting. It's like the space between something happening and you being aware of your own thoughts and feelings. It's allowing to drop in the present and being able to play the position in front of you. Not to play the position you lost yesterday and not thinking about your pairings of the afternoon, but just being focused on what's in front of you. So it's a whole set of skills, really, that allow you to really basically drop into here and now. And that pays massive dividends, both during a game, between games, really giving you like a little bit of extra headspace.
Would you say, I'll just say for myself, it feels like even when my knowledge is increasing and my puzzle skill is increasing, there are still times when I just feel out of form. And I'm wondering if something like this kind of addresses that. It's not about the last week's tournament and the week before that. It's just about taking the knowledge and skills you have and playing a game with them, right? It's not about your form or your lack of form, just playing the game. Do you feel like this approach kind of addresses that?
You mean when you don't feel like really on form?
Yeah, I guess what I mean is like I went through a 6-month period where I was clearly getting better at chess, but my results, I was just going through a terrible run where I just kept losing. And I'm wondering if something like that would help me reset each game rather than have the lingering losses accumulating in my headspace, taking up that valuable place, dragging me down as I'm trying to play my current game. But I have these things going like, but you've lost like 22 of your last 28 games.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's to really get into a great, zone of playing. There's several tools, right? We've got like basically a whole toolbox, and as a coach, is the skill is going to be like, what is really going to help that particular player with that particular thing? And so, for example, we can focus on like breathing tool if you really need to act on the nervous system. And the mindfulness is going to be useful to, basically being able to catch these, unwanted thoughts and feelings, so that then you can let them go. And then there's like further exercises that you can do if you need to let them go. Basically, the ability to really somehow psych yourself for a game, for lack of a better word, is really important. And and there are tools for this, definitely, to like, yeah, I'm not feeling it so much, but like, you know, let's bring it down. And this is where, for example, something that is that very few players are doing is a pre-performance routine, you know, a little ritual. Now, whether that's like, you know, whether that's like meditation, whether that's breathing, whether that's visualization, whether it is self-talk, you know, all of these different tools, it matters less than having one. You know, if you have one that works for you, that's fantastic. Whether it's like breathing, visualization, self-talk, you know, all these like type of tools, but having one is quite important. And too few players. What I love is that Vidit has been, you know, at the Grand Swiss. You could see him on first move on his clock time, just focus for like, you know, more than 30 seconds, which feels like hours. And I'm sure if you're in front of him, it must feel like hours. Like, what is this guy doing? But whatever he's doing, it's clearly, you know, allowing him to be in the correct headspace. So, you know, I would encourage people to try to find their own little routine as well. From you know, there's plenty of also free resources, and you know, you can always tinker with what works for you.
Yeah, I guess the question I have is like, when you say a routine, does it have to be at the board, or can it be like, you know, before you leave your house for the event? Like, do you have a time scale you're thinking? Does it need to be right before it, or can it be, you know, 20 minutes before or an hour before?
I think it must be right before it.
Okay.
In a way, the way Vidit does it. What I love to teach people is like, okay, you're gonna aim for being in what you call the zone, right? Or you call it zone, you call it flow, you got it like correct headspace, you call it mindset, whatever. The first question is like, what does this feel like? Because the first question is, people don't even know what it feels like. So I like to say, okay, pick a game in which you played your best chess, okay? And then we go through this to bring the memory of what it feels like. Because, you know, what does this little tension, you know, this feeling of really striving, you know, at the razor edge of your capability, knowing that, you know, your opponent also playing good moves. So, you know, you've got this extreme balance of pushing your limit at playing at your best. Let's try to remember what this feels like. And then if it's like having, you know, imagine you've got this and it's like you put it in a little bottle, and you, if you could drink that feeling just before your game, you would, right? So of course, you know, we're metaphorically by memory trying to bring back this this feeling of playing your best chess.
Right. So it sounds like it's not just like clearing your mind and being relaxed, but it's also like turning your brain towards chess and being ready to engage in the battle that is to come.
So you need to, you know, you need to tune your nervous system to whatever is appropriate right now. And maybe if you just blundered a pawn and you were winning, now it's a draw, or now you're going to fight for even drawing, like maybe you need to calm down. Okay. Yeah. Maybe you need to breathe. Maybe you're like a little tired, or you're like not bothered, or you're on a string of long losses, and you need to find this tension, this like feeling of being at your best, then that's what you need to bring. But, and this is where mindfulness helps, because mindfulness helps you to know where you are. You need, you know, to reach a destination, you need the knowledge of two things: where you want to be and where you are. So if you are too stressed or not enough, which tools, you know, do you have in your toolbox to help you go in that direction? Yeah. And what's great about mindfulness is that skill of knowing where you are will be useful in such a wide variety of situations.
Yeah, this is really resonating for me. I have very strong memories of tournaments in bowl situations, right? There's this one tournament I remember vividly, three straight games. I was winning in all of them. And in all three games, I started kind of like losing my focus, losing my killer instinct. And I could feel it, but I didn't have the skills to be able to kind of be like, stop, Kevin, turn it around. Let's get back in and let's finish the game. And I lost all three games. I didn't even draw these games. I lost them up a piece in two of them. And it was the start of this, of like a 6 month spiral then of like reflecting on that and then losing more and, you know, having these kind of tools in the moment, I think, to either hype yourself up or calm yourself and settle yourself when something chaotic has happened. And now we're in an even end game and you need to really be focused on the matter at hand. I think these are incredibly valuable tools. Okay. So it sounds like you've gotten to do this work with quite a few people. How did you get paired up with the English Olympiad team?
So I was already working privately with, I was just hesitating right now because I think I'm not gonna name the player, but sure. I was working with one of them privately. And then they were like, well, that'd be great if, like, you know, you could help the whole team. And I was like, that's fantastic, because, you know, I really wanted to work with a team. And at the end, the head of the, I had to the opportunity to pitch to Malcolm, the head of the director of international chess, and it was, he was like, yeah, that's let's give it a go. So, you know, huge thanks to Malcolm for being you know, forward looking in that aspect. And I do hope I was helpful on site, because, you know, you need to be there in a way to, yeah, you know, discuss with the players and so on, because it's like a lot of organic interaction. But being, I mean, for a 1700, you know, club player, being in the middle of the hall with the world elite, mm-hmm. And seeing what's happening, how they behave.
Yeah.
I just learned so much about high level chess, and that was a fantastic experience. And really, I can't be more grateful to Malcolm for trusting me.
And so, like, you see a grandmaster make a blunder, you come up to him in the middle of the game and you're like, you've blundered, now let's calm ourselves. Now, I imagine that was not how it worked. But that sounds pretty great.
No, you can. Yeah. You can pick so many things in terms of, you
yeah,
know,
how do they respond?
Also, a lot of, when you're on the other side of the curtains, when you're with the players, you also understand a lot of, like, you know, there's life happening, and mm-hmm. and, you know, yeah, people get sick or they get like personal circumstances, and then, like, as a fan, like, you know, a team does well or doesn't do well, and you don't understand quite well. But when you're behind the curtains, you're like, yeah, that's obviously, you know, this, yeah, and that happened, and I could see it. But
right,
you know, obviously you don't disclose any of these you know, such knowledge. But yeah, it was fascinating.
Yeah, so it sounds like the most important work for, say, an amateur player is going to take place, you know, between games, giving yourself the tools so that when you get in that position in the game, you can tap into those tools, right?
Yeah. So for any player, it's like all the tools that will help you play your best chess. That's the thing. But I think for amateurs, and you know what? I think amateurs and pros are quite similar in terms of how important chess is in their life, because, and I'm sure you know, for, like, you know, hosting all this,
yeah,
for a lot of amateur players, chess is very important.
Yeah,
it's an important part of their life. So, you know, trying to find the balance and understanding, you know, trying to keep alive your love for the game, things mm-hmm. like this, they're so important. And I love to, you know, do this work with someone, and and make sure, like, okay, why did you love chess in the first place? And often people get really competitive and they have goals, and then, like, you know, they attach huge meaning of their own identity to, you know, reaching 2000, 2200, 2400, 2500. And then if they're struggling along this goal, that will cause like huge issues, because it's like, well, it's such a big part of my life, and I wanted to reach that such and such number, and now, well, what do I, like, it's becoming a burden, and it's like, okay, how can we make sure to keep doing things, but, you know, getting back to the love of playing, and so that you will continue on that goal. Maybe, like, you know, you still want to do best and reach these numbers, but doing it in a healthy way, you know, with a healthy relationship with between you and your rating and you and chess and the place of chess in your life.
Yeah, that all sounds so great, especially when I think we sometimes forget just how personal our chess rating goals are. Like, there's almost no one else in the whole universe that cares what your rating is, right? Like, my family does not care about my rating. My students already think I'm, like, as good as Magnus Carlsen, which is hilarious. They'll be like, how close are you to Magnus? Like, if you guys played 10 games, would you win, like, 4? And I'm like, what? No, I would not win 4 games against Magnus. He would win them all. What are you talking about? So it is just such a personal part of your life, and I think we sometimes get far too obsessed with that very personal thing. I think we have this idea that people are judging us on our rating, and it's like, that is very likely not the case. There might be one person at your chess club that's like, bah, you're only 1600, I only talk to 1700 pluses, and you know what, that is their problem, not your problem. Don't worry about that person. That person's got issues.
Yeah. But you know what? That's why your podcast is fantastic, because you have such a wide array of guests, and we can really see different trajectories and different relationship with their own chess improvement and what chess is in their life. Because it's, if you only look at the superstars, you know, and the kids on meteoritic trajectories, you kind of get skewed. It's like, well, shouldn't I be like improving like super fast? Like, yeah. I never hear about anyone else like improving slowly.
Right. Yep. Yeah. You don't hear about the prodigy kids that don't get better, that aren't prodigies. Like, there's so many kids that are not prodigies, right? Like, there's lots of kids that just like chess and they play and they go to tournaments and their rating only goes up a little bit, like adults. And that's fine. It's just, we hear about the kids that had this, you know, like, I gained 1,000 points over 2 years kind of kids. But like, my daughter goes to tournaments and she's been going for a year now to Scholastic tournaments. And there's kids that are right along with her. She's gained over this year 200 points, and tons of other kids have gained 200 points in a year also. And you're like, that's, you know, that's still great. I would love to gain 200 points in a year, but, you know, it's not 1,000 like we often hear about. I think that's a good point. I'm curious. So you've done a lot of work with mental chess, and it seems like that's going great. And you have some resources, by the way. What is your main resource? The course is called Mindfulness for the amateur, for the tournament player.
For the tournament. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So this
who
was
do you
launched,
recommend for that course? Like, who would do well with a course like that?
Anyone who plays tournaments. I think that's what I designed it for. Because it's the course is structured like a menu, in terms of, like, it's not a course where you start, it's not like, you know, start at the beginning and watch it all through to the end. It's there's a chapter of like a practice to do before your game, and then there's like practices after your game. So there's like, if you've lost and you need to let go of a strong emotion, there's a session for that. If you've won, there's also a session for that. If you need to rest, there's like a deep rest session, and there's a session for the end of the tournament. There's also a little bonus about how to do a small pre-performance routine. So if that's an aspect that you were intrigued buy when I talked about it earlier. It's something you can get from the course as well. So it's definitely about, you know, just picking and choosing things from the course. The course is video, but there's an audio as well, so you, which you can download on your phone. Other than that, I have a Substack, which I started, more than a year ago now. And it's been like actually been steadily growing. I've been writing very infrequently. I kind of struggle at writing, to be honest. But I really do put a lot of love and efforts in all my posts. So be sure to check that out. I'm sure there's going to be a link in the show notes.
Yeah, there will be. Real quick about the mindfulness for the tournament player. I was looking at the course and I assumed it would be like all the other chess courses I've looked at. And so I started looking at it and very quickly it was like, all right, now we're going to do this. Like this course is the exercises. And I was like, oh, wow. Okay. Wow. So it is a very much, I feel like, a hands-on, like you said, this is how you do this. This is how you do this. We're actually going to do it right now. So it is really a course. It's less about, I felt like it was less about telling you how to do something and more like, let's do it together. Let's do the work together.
Yeah. There's basically every session has like a 4 or 5 minutes intro video about like, this is what we're going to do because of that's, you know, introduce the why we're doing this and how it's going to work. And then the actual video is like, the actual session is 10 minutes. But of course, the how you only watch once or twice, right? Then you only worry about the main like 10-minute segments.
Okay. Last questions I have for you are about data science. I'm curious how you've brought data science into your own studying, or how you bring it into chess generally. I noticed, like you already said, your Substack, I was looking at a really cool article on shark points and it looked fascinating of like, my takeaway was, you're probably gonna think this is lame. It's like, oh, cool. So I have another metric to figure out, like, am I doing okay, right? Like I can be like, well, I lose all my games, but my shark points are really high.
Yeah. I somehow went into coaching because I really wanted to have something where I helped people directly. So where it's not like focused on numbers. But somehow I still also love analytics. So I've got like, you know, a little bit of a foot in both world. And so I've done a few things which are analytics related, you know, with chess, you know. I've done a little bit of custom work for players, looking at like, you know, various metrics inside their games. And I've sometimes there's a topic. And for example, the team chess. Okay, that was an interesting one where I start to think about it and then I run some experiments and I do a little bit of you know, programming, and then I'm like, now, once this problem's in my head, it needs to come out. and then like, you know, I need to write a blog post about it just to say, okay, now that's into the world. And I've loved, you know, thinking about it, but that's not my, you know, primary love. I guess what I really love is more of the mental aspect, but somehow there's still like, you know, analytic stuff, which I think analytics are so underused in chess. It's criminal. And definitely, for example, so these chalk points is now expected goals are quite important in soccer, which is like basically, you know, because in soccer only one or two goals are scored, but how many times have they shot on goal, you know, like how many goals would they have scored if the game had been played 1,000 times? So I was, you know, wanting to quantify this for chess. And you know what? Now it's in the world. If people want to pick it up and do stuff with it, but somehow it's like any kind of statistics is really like more like just like win prediction. And people don't do a lot with the the in-game stuff, not so much. So, you know, I'd love for this aspect of chess to get bigger, but I'm not going to be the driving force behind it.
Gotcha. Like if I sent you my last 50 tournament games, you said you've used analytics sometimes. Like what would you look at? What kind of things would you use analytics? Or what, let me rephrase that. What might you want someone else to, who that was the thing they were spending their time? What would you think would be a useful use of that?
Yeah, I have I've done a few custom studies that I've not any not seen anyone look at with respect to move times. And so, you know, if you can get a data set with timestamp of every move, then you can start looking at like what's happening after your long think and why. I know Dan has worked on actually done quite great work with this, but I played with stuff like this. Also looking at things in terms of game time. When do blunders happen for some players? Because some players will be losing the game in the third or fourth hour of play. So in that term, like it's like, well, we need to work on playing endurance for example. So you know, that's just like little one-off studies I've done like this. But you know, I'm sure this will some because the game's getting bigger, so people will recognize the value of analytics, I think, and also the value of you know, mental coaching and things like that. So I think you know, it's really an interesting time for chess. I think somehow where there's like when there's a lot of availability for data and for tools, people don't quite know how to harness it or make it interesting. But you know, with time, it's gonna really you know, I think get more interesting for the viewers.
Yeah, I think I'm hearing a big takeaway, at least for myself, is I should start writing down timestamps in my constructed game so I at least have that data when I decide to do that. Should I be writing down the time? Yeah, I never do. I don't know why. Okay.
I think I think you should. You know, data is the lifeblood of a lot of things. So you know, looking at your own timestamp might be giving you some interesting insights. Okay. Of course, you've got to also. It's always like any kind of metric, you really need to think and see what does it help you to understand. Like the metric is never the replacement of like the understanding, because it's always like in context, like, oh, I always do bad about after my long thinks. And it's like, well, maybe you do your long thinks because you're in a very tricky position in the first place. So
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like this kind of, as long as people use analytics you know, enhance their understanding and not as like, well, no, I have a number and I don't need to think anymore. That's going to be useful.
Yeah, gotcha. All right. Well, this sounds amazing. I don't even know what to say other than. Now I am really inspired to do some real thinking about my own mindfulness. What is my approach like when I sit down at a board? How do I handle these situations where I'm disengaging, where I'm too amped up? Are they affecting my gameplay? So I'm going to try to be a little bit more aware of that myself. But I think I need to, at a minimum, find some exercises to re-engage when I feel myself pulling away, because this often happens, especially in hour three. My brain is just kind of like, you know, Kevin, I've given you 3 good hours. I don't know what you're expecting from me, right? Like, I think 3 good hours is good. You're an old man now. Why don't we just do something different now? Go watch some Netflix for just like an hour and then we can come back to this game. And unfortunately, you can't do that in the middle of a game.
Yeah, chess is like, it's really like a combat sport or like boxing. You know, if you switch off 1 second, you're knocked out. Yeah. But it's not like 3 minutes round. It's like 3 hours round or more. So it's really quite unique. And that's what makes it also fascinating. It's like you get this, you're really locking horns at the board for so many hours in such a tense situation. And I think every chess player is drawn to this fight. And it's about like, you know, getting yourself a few extra tools and a few extra understanding of your own mind. And you know what, like, there's never one size fits all or one thing, the one trick you need to know. Like, you're the expert about, like, you know, what your own problems and shortcomings are. So it's definitely, you know, starts with, like, you know, a little bit of introspection. And if you understand your own problem, then, like, it's a lot easier to find, like, you know, extra tools to help you out.
Yeah. Do you have any specific suggestions of a more one size fits all of when someone feels like they're sort of disengaging in a position a few hours in? Is it like a breathing exercise? Is it going in the bathroom, looking at yourself in the mirror and slapping yourself until you're more awake? Like,
yeah, definitely breathing helps you out because, you know, you can play on the ratio of inhale to exhale. And depending on what that ratio is, you will activate either sympathetic or parasympathetic nervous system. So, you know, typically what type of breathing you'd use to calm you down, the mirror image will help you to, you know, boost yourself up. But again, it's first, I'd say the sequence would go like this: is first getting the awareness that you need this little boost. This is like, you know, where mindfulness comes in. And then it's like, okay, I'm going to need to refocus myself and maybe, you know, act on my nervous system. And breathing's fantastic because breathing just works, so to speak, because if it acts on the nervous system, there's a lot less room for error than if you just have, like, you know, something that goes in your mind. Definitely, you know, so if you want to psych yourself up, you basically need like short, powerful exhales and long inhales, right? Because, and the opposite will like calm you down, you know, doing like long exhale is like how you bring yourself down. Okay. So the conversely, the long inhale and short exhale is like, you know, you do this three times, that should bring yourself back up a little bit.
And I feel like if you do it loudly enough, it'll kind of freak out your opponent. Like, wait, what the heck is this guy doing? All right. Well, good stuff, my friend. I've got a lot to think about myself. I imagine my viewers do as well. As you said, us amateurs are so invested in chess and in our chess and in getting better at chess that, like, this feels like an area, at least for myself, that has been relatively unexplored. And you know, tournament chess is where you try to take all that knowledge and skill and put it into use. And if you can't do it well because your mindfulness isn't there, it feels like there's a lot of points being left on the table that could just be scooped up and put into our little points jar or whatever analogy we want to use. All right, Benji, well, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. It has been quite a conversation. I know I've learned a lot. Sounds like people can get your course. They can go to Mindcreaser, your Substack. There's a lot of information you have out there. Anything else you want to tell people where they can connect with you?
Yeah, my Substack, my Twitter. I'd like to say thank you so much for having me on, Kevin. I think your podcast is fantastic. It really has a super important role in the podcast sphere, pod sphere. Just like, you know, keep up the great work.
All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Well, everybody out there, I hope this is the week where you gain a lot of points. Maybe you start working on your mindfulness. Maybe you sit down on the chessboard and you realize the 12 losses you had before this are not actually impacting your current chess. Maybe it's your mindfulness and where you're at and how you're processing those losses, and you're able to sort this all out and turn everything around. If it's not, well, that's okay. We'll have another guest next week. We'll talk about their journey, and I'll see you next time, everybody. Goodbye.